serving Jesus in Guatemala. So the idea for today is sort of a survivor wrap-up show, only we all survived. No one got voted off the island, and no one got $1 million. So just looking forward to hearing from the team of some of the things the Lord's been teaching them, what they've been hearing from God in the process of both being in Guatemala and coming back, of course. And let me first kind of set the stage just briefly so you have some context for where we were going and what we were doing, especially if our partnership as a church in Guatemala is new to you, it'll help frame that in a little bit. We get to Guatemala City, and there's really two ministries we partner with, and then a few little offshoots of those, but two ministries primarily. And the first is in the city of Guatemala City, in the largest urban slum in all of Central America, in a little strip of land called La Limonada, a real dark and a very, very difficult place with poverty like I've never seen anywhere else in the world. And there's about 60 to 70,000 people that live in that little area. And for those of you who are history nerds or like geographic types of anthropology, just search La Limonada and Guatemala City and you'll get a bit of the backstory on what's going on there and why we partner. We partner with an organization there called Vidas Plenas, which, because my Spanish is so good, I've been told that that means life abundant or life to the full. I speak fluent Guatemalan, which is not actually a language at all. So, but we partner there with Vidas Plenas in the city. The leader of that organization is a woman named Tita, who we've grown to love. So you might hear people talk about Vidas Plenas or Limonada or Tita. Those are that's the ministry there. And they have some academies there in the city, in the slum, that would look akin to a daycare by U.S. standards, providing meals and education and safe care for kids. We also partner with the second ministry about an hour away out in the rural hills of Guatemala in an area called Jocotillo. And there are a number of little sort of mountain villages around Jocotillo that all have somewhere between 75 and maybe 200 families that live in a little village where there's no clean water. There's certainly no running water, but no clean water, very little electricity, very few services out there. And we serve out there with a church plant that we helped get started some number of years ago. And we still partner with. The pastors of that church are a husband and wife, Pastor Irwin and Irma. And so you'll hear us talk about Jocotillo and the villages that surround Jocotillo and the churches that we work with. That area is where we do the Ecofiltro program. For those who are familiar with that, you know what that is. For those not, Ecofiltro is a 5-gallon bucket with a filtration system inside of it that was actually designed and manufactured in Guatemala. So we purchase those from a social entrepreneurship in Guatemala and then provide them to Guatemalans to give them clean water for 2 years. The number of deaths in that country because of dirty water would boggle your mind. So those are some of the ministries that we work with, some of the projects that we've done in the past. I'm at this point going to kind of hand the microphone over, and I'll kind of emcee this. Team, what in the world did God teach you in your time in Guatemala?
So one of the big things that I took away from it, we were going into the slums and coming out and going back to the city. And one of the days while we were driving back, I was reflecting on the things that we saw and God's presence there, even though it's a slum with injustices and just the people living in complete poverty. And yet God is still present there and working in these people's hearts to the point where they say, "God bless you," while you're walking down the street. They pray with you, and it's openly accepted there. And as we're driving back to the city one day, I'm realizing, well, even when we get back to the city in Guatemala City, that's not as prevalent anymore. The further out away from the technology and the hustle and bustle you get, the more God is visible. God is still present in the cities, and even here in the States, still very present, just the same as it is in the slums, but just distracted. We're so distracted by everything we have, and the people that have not, it's right in their faces. They're not distracted, and So the biggest takeaway that I got in the spiritual sense is being able to shut out those distractions, unclutter the life a little bit, and look at what God's doing, even in the places where all the distractions are, and people don't see it as much.
One of the things for me with going to Guatemala this year was that it was the completion of a call that had been put on my heart shortly after my husband and I started coming to Disciples. Stu had just gone to Guatemala, I believe, for the first time and had shared about his experiences and his hopes and dreams that this was going to be our mission field that we were going to partner with and we were going to build into. And for me, it's been 2 years of just waiting for God to say, this is the moment. And it was incredible on this trip to feel the sense of community with the team, as at different points we would have interactions and we would share when we started feeling that we were going to go to Guatemala and the pull towards it. And each of us, it seemed like we had, it wasn't just a spur of the moment, like we heard about it this year and decided we were going to do it for the first time. It was something that we'd been leaning into and hearing God speak about for quite a while. And it was just fantastic to see that so oftentimes the way God works, we miss it with our human eyes as he's building towards something. And as I was down there going through experiences and being on this team, it was amazing that in different moments you would connect with one person on the team or another person. And every once in a while I just look up, and it wasn't even within our team, this sense of community, but seeing someone on our team partnering with the teachers at the academies or stepping aside and talking to Tita or having a few moments with Erwin and Irma, that we truly are the hands and feet of God. We are this entire body, and it really came alive for me while we were down in Guatemala.
As somewhat of an unintended consequence, because of my profession, I had become kind of compassion fatigued. So when I went there by about the second day, I was kind of like, oh, this is just the same. I've been to kind of worse cities than this. And by about the second day, when Tito was walking us around, showing us the gunshot holes that were in the sides of the buildings, or she would stop. At one point, she told Jason, just pray for this man, pray for this man, pray for this man. And she was talking to him. And he went up the hill, robbed somebody, came back down, bought drugs, was on drugs. Jason's praying over the guy. It was just real. By the second day, I had become really just kind of broke, full of compassion, going to the, you know, we went to this huge dump. We saw these people shuffling through all this trash, trying to find recyclable goods. And I kept thinking about the children that we were teaching in the morning and how they may wind up there going through trash someday for a job. And it's just the level of injustice there is just really overwhelming. It's very eye-opening. And it's just something that just will always stay in my heart and I'll always pray about.
So the first few days when we were there, we were in La Limonada, which Stu already mentioned is the largest slum in Central America, arguably the most violent. The people there, the children there, experience things that you and I will never experience. But we ministered at the schools there. And one of the things that really struck me was we were in a classroom of 6 to 7-year-olds, and on the wall was a board that had their schedule for every day. And one of the things that they're taught, one of the classes that they're taught, is sex education. This is 6 and 7-year-olds. So I had to explain to my 12-year-old why it is that 6 and 7-year-olds have to be taught sex education. Well, the thing is, in this neighborhood, in this area, I think something like 80% of the girls are sexually abused. They're raped by family members, by sometimes their brothers. Some of the boys in this academy that I looked at, I knew would grow up to be abusers themselves. Some of them are abusers right now. They're maybe abusing their sisters. But I was in a classroom And I was watching these kids play, and you would not know that they experienced any abuse by their behavior. They were acting like normal kids. They were happy. They were joyful. They were laughing. They were talking. They were interacting with us. They were playing Legos. And I had this realization. I sat there and I just stared at these kids and I thought, most of these children, most of these girls are going to go home, and they seem so joyful right now, and they're going to go home, and they quite possibly could get raped today. And it's not something that we is in our face all the time. It's not something that we experience. But what I kind of took from that was the Lord kind of told me that, you know, how is it that I can be so affected by the inconveniences of my life and not experience the joy of the Lord all the time, when these children who experience such far worse things than I do still have such joy in their hearts? And it was just such an eye-opening experience for me.
One of the things that was impactful is we got a chance to sit and talk with Tita. And she got to pretty much share her heart with us. And as much poverty as there is in La Limonada, she's not working to end poverty. She's working to end injustice. And she has a new, she had a perspective on there, which was, it was pretty amazing. I mean, with us coming from a comfortable society, it's like poverty makes us uncomfortable. And so we kind of want to end poverty, but she feels like in the poverty, there's things in there that it's not bad. They're content with what they have because they have so little. Like the more you have, the more you want. It's like you, in affluent societies, you don't really know what your needs are versus your wants. A lot of times our wants, we think are our needs. With them, their needs are very basic and very few. They need a place to sleep. They need food, you know. They need clothes, and that's just about it. So, and that's just about all they have. So her perspective on poverty, it was really, it shifted. It gave me a new perspective on that. And it's the injustices that people take out on those that are in poverty is really what is what we should be really concerned with ending.
There were so many times throughout the week that we just had interactions that you just know, and I think I can speak for all of us in this, but you just know, this moment I will never forget. You know how you have some of those moments every, you know, once in a while, and you just know this is a moment I'll never forget. And we just had, you know, one of those like every day, and interactions with people every day. I want to just challenge the team to share an interaction or two that you had, somebody that you met, an experience you had that you know you'll never forget. Our first trip down a number of years ago was Jen and Isaac, our oldest, and myself. And I'll get all the numbers wrong, but I think Isaac was about 12 or 13 at the time. And we met a boy while we were there whose name is Anderson, who is around about the same age. And Anderson's dad also was a pastor. And we learned that just less than a year prior to that, Anderson's dad had died when a tree fell on him and killed him. Just this horrible fluke tragedy, terrible thing. And so all week long we're there, and you just see this sad little 12, 13-year-old boy who's lost his dad. And it would just overwhelm me at times as I would look at my own son who was there. And, you know, as a dad, there are moments where, you know, you kind of are thinking about how to take your own kid out, right? You know? And yet I was overwhelmed so many times with that. And so each time I've gone back, I've wanted to go hunt down Anderson, you know, and find Anderson. And I've watched him grow over the last 3 years a little bit. And he's, like I said, about Isaac's age, and he's probably 15, 16 now, maybe 14, 15. And so we got there this week, and I asked Pastor Irwin, hey, where's Anderson? How's Anderson? He said, oh, Anderson's good. I just could discern something wasn't quite right in what Pastor was telling me. And it was a very common thing at least in that Guatemalan culture, that when the white pastor asks you how something's going, you just say good, because the white pastor brings money. And so you never tell him anything's not good. You just, it's, everything's always great, because God forbid you know, we would find out they're imperfect like we are, right? Or, you know, something's not going great. So I pressed him a little bit because I sensed something wasn't right. And he finally told me, yeah, no, Anderson's not good at all. He's not following Jesus. He's really angry. So you have to take me to Anderson's house. So we went and I just got to spend a few minutes with Anderson, he and I, and the rest of the team kind of backed away and just let me and Anderson talk for a few minutes. And just a powerful moment that reminded me again, I didn't have anything profound to tell him. I didn't have a good sermon. I didn't have anything interesting. I just loved this kid and told him he was always on my mind and I thought about him. And it reminded me how powerful a word of encouragement can be over someone's life. And how often when I'm in the States that I just skip it. Because I think I'll look like a softie or I'm just lazy and don't want to do it. Or I might actually have to listen to God to hear the encouraging word from my friend or whatever it is. And just reminded how powerful that encouraging word is in somebody's life. And, so I just ask you, pray with me for my friend Anderson. He's mad. And he says he won't follow God because he's mad at God for taking his dad who loved Jesus. And I said, well, do you still talk to God? And he said, yeah, I still talk to God, but I usually only tell him how mad I am. And I said, good for you, man. He can handle it. Just don't stop talking to God. And, so pray for Anderson. He's got a special place in my heart. So. Somebody else, powerful interaction.
When we're in the inner city of La Limonada, we get the chance to serve in a couple of the academies while we're there. And the last trip and this trip, we had the chance to actually teach lessons to several of the different classes in La Limonada. So we went down there the first day. We were fairly well prepared and kind of taught our lesson, and it kind of bombed a little bit, so much to the point that the teachers the rest of the day just had us play with Legos with the kids in every class we were in. And you know, maybe that was even more valuable, getting to just spend time with them than the lesson. But as we went into day two, we had split up into two groups, and our group huddled down in kind of a lower level of the academy, and we were preparing, and we had decided that we were going to nail it today, and we prayed a very strong prayer for God to help us along with that. And the kind of the lesson plan was really designed to instill on the kids how important they are and how valuable they are to God and to us and to the people that care for them. Because as you can imagine, in this dark depths of the inner city, there's not a whole lot of value for human life, and there's not a whole lot of self-respect and self-value as these kids don't have a whole lot of hope in life. So one of the cool things was Megan brought down a Polaroid camera. And so after we finished kind of the initial part of the lesson, we took a photo of each of the kids and wrote "You're important" in Spanish on the bottom of the photos. And as we started taking the pictures of the kids, we noticed that the two teachers in the class started putting on makeup. And we're really excited to have us take their photo also. So that to me was one of the biggest bright spots of the whole trip, and definitely champion Megan for having the wherewithal to think how valuable that would be an experience for each of the kids.
Our team, the other group, we led a bunch of kids to Jesus and baptized them. No big deal, though. I mean, it was really nice of you guys to take pictures. That was really, it's really cute. Our kids are going to spend eternity in heaven. Whatever. We might have been a little competitive between the two groups, and they might have thought they beat us that day. So, you know.
We were just confident. We didn't have to be competitive. We got it. It's okay.
Somebody else, an experience.
So one time, one of our last days in the city, we stopped by a little shop, and Megan thought it would be a good idea to buy a lot of ice cream. So we rounded up some of the kids, and we started passing out ice cream to them. And then, so we're driving back in the bus, and while we're leaving the city, a bunch of kids come up to the car, and it was so funny, or so cute, seeing the smiles on their faces as we just passed out ice cream through the window.
So when we were in Limonada, like Sean had said, we were playing Legos with the kids, and the day before, we had been playing with like 5 and 6 year olds. And they were so happy. We gave them pages to color and these little like glow in the dark bracelets, and we all most of us speak very little Spanish, and you know, you didn't really need to be able to talk to them that much. They were so happy, and they were like coloring my fingernails with crayons. It was great. And then we went to another class of 10, 11, 12-year-olds, something like that. And they were not nearly as happy. Like, we were trying to play Legos with them, and Ruth and Sean and I were on a bench, and there were these two little boys across from us. And one kid was, like, kind of into it, you know. And Sean and Ruth and I were, like, jumping up and down and trying as hard as we can to, like, just be funny or something, you know, just get him to smile. And this other kid just would not smile. He would barely crack a smile the whole time. And I was kind of disappointed. I was like, I'm putting a lot of effort into this. Come on, guys. Like, you know, and Sean was like, you know, this, I couldn't last a day in this kid's shoes. It, you know, it's okay. And as we left, the whole group basically said the same thing. Like, none of us were really getting through these kids. And someone made the comment, like, yeah, you know, we're, these kids have seen more. They've experienced more. They've seen more violence. And they're not as happy as the six-year-olds. And they've been taught to be tough and not show emotion. And it was heartbreaking to see just the transition that, like, 4 years would make. You know, a few years, these kids should be having fun, playing soccer, you know. But you could tell they just weren't really into it. And it was a little bit heartbreaking. As we left, I turned around and I saw the little boy actually started playing with the toy that we had made for him. And so it was nice to see that he, I think, hopefully enjoyed it a little bit. But it was, at the same time, heartbreaking to realize that he didn't feel that he could show us that.
So I had the privilege of staying another week. I got to try and get through this. But I ended up going to another school where they brought in abandoned kids, abandoned babies, 12-year-old moms from, most of them were molested and got pregnant that way. One of the things that brought perspective of the kids that we saw in La Limonada was a 7-year-old girl was brought in. It was her first time there that had just been taken advantage of. And she was in so much pain, doubled over crying. And she was angry at the guy that did it and said if she ever saw the guy, she was going to drown herself. And so that's the things these kids are seeing. And to see these kids that are stone-faced, it's because from that age of 5 to 7, they've seen so much that they're kind of shutting off to the world. And that's something that was really hard to see.
So when we would walk around through these different academies, there were ladies that were teaching the classes, and they were kind of like our bodyguards. They were these, you know, teenage, kind of like older women that would walk around, and nobody in the streets messed with them, and they would pray for people, and they would walk us around. And on our last day in La Limonada, they all kind of encircled us and said that we want to pray for you, and they all started praying kind of at the same time. And it was really just the most unbelievable thing I've ever experienced. I'm totally going to remember that forever. Just all these women praying over us that we would be blessed. And the situation that they were in, teaching these children. I mean, we prayed for these people a lot, but if there were people in the room that needed prayers, you know, it was definitely them. So I'll never, ever forget that. That's for sure.
One of the people we all met, you might know the name, before we even got there, was Diego. And we had such a fun time with him. He's such a great character.
I'm going to interrupt really fast. How many of you have already received a friend request on Facebook from Diego? Look around the room. Diego's going to hunt you down, people, I'm telling you.
He's so much fun and has so much spirit and loves to see new things, and he's learning English, and I think he'll get it down. He's got it. But so one of my favorite memories, he's awesome. He's looking for his partner in life. So Tom here wants to set him up with the girl there. And talking a little bit, when I find out, I'm like, let's go meet her. Let's go talk to her. Come on. And no, she has a girlfriend. Besides, I want a gringa anyways. I kind of pause. Yeah, you do, because you want to see the world, see different things. But also, does he want somebody from America because they have privilege and they have aspirations and they have things. And so I didn't know whether he wanted that luxury or if that's truly who he's attracted to. So I just hope that he finds who he's meant to be with and keeps up his laughter every day, because he's great. He's a great guy.
Yeah, so the first night that we're there, we go to Pollo Campero. It's a restaurant they have there, and he's sitting across from us. And so he asked me, tu hija? I'm like, no, mi esposa. He was trying to steal my wife, so that's why I was trying to get him set up with somebody else so he'd get his attention off my wife. So, but Sue, what were you trying to teach him? Hola, Dolphins?
Hola, Dolphins, yeah. Somebody else, experiences you'll never forget.
It was so fun because Diego is a large personality and he is very enjoyable to be around. But one of my favorite moments with Diego was one he probably didn't even know I observed. But on the day after they had kind of some after school classes, and then they had come out and they'd had a devotional time. And then typically after that, they get to go play soccer and just run and have fun. But on that day, it just started raining so bad. And so they weren't allowed to go out, and they were all standing under the covered balcony. And so the kids started getting a little rowdier and rowdier. And then all of a sudden, Diego walks out, and he just starts snapping his fingers, directing kids, and they just all stopped immediately what they were doing. The most respect I've seen instantaneously for a teacher, and just started following his directions immediately. And it was just a great insight to who he really is in that community, that as we're laughing and playing and being silly with him and enjoying his large personality, that he has such a heart for the ministry that he's doing, and the kids just feel the outpouring of love for them so much that they just instantly follow his directions when he gave them. That was an incredible moment.
There were a bunch of themes throughout the week that we just felt God sort of threading through our experience, and a lot of that we'll just be processing for a long time. And for those of you who've been on the Guatemala trip in the past, you've gone ahead of us to some extent and processed some of that. But one of the things that we just saw over and over again that I think rattled all of us was the way that people were attentive to the voice of God, and how important it was to the Christ followers in Guatemala that they hear God speak to them. Something that is fairly foreign to us, at least a lot of the time. Reflect back, team, some of the ways that you were inspired as you saw leaders listening for God, as we banded together to discern God's voice at times. What are you learning about hearing the voice of God?
As I was reflecting, one of the things that came to my mind was, in one of the pictures, we are praying over a spot that they actually want to have be the second church that they plant in this. Was that Santa Maria?
Gallardo.
Yeah. So it was their second. It was a second church that would actually be a part of their planting, and they're praying for this church and for leadership for this church, and you know, a few of us got to kind of hear a little bit more of the background of, as much as they have this really established church, there's a lot of politics and other things that are going on, and how Erwin and Irma they're not about building their own empire. One of the things that we saw as we're driving there, we passed this massive building that when you look at it, you think it's a soccer stadium. And then you see a sign, no, it's a church. And it's, I guess, the biggest church in Guatemala, and the thing's massive. But Erwin and Irma, they're not worried about their little plot of land. If, that goes away or whatever happens, they're not worried about that. They're still just trying to plant all these little churches that can minister to these local neighborhoods. Because, in this town, there was two other churches, but they were so far away in the town that that local neighborhood just wasn't being ministered to. And so they were praying for this new church to be built and for, you know, listening for God's voice of, you know, what do you want to have here and who do you want to have serve here and, you know, what leadership do you want to bring? And, you know, they're so focused on building God's kingdom and not at all interested in their own empire. It was so humbling to see.
God did so many things this last week. It was like a continuous stream of him just talking. I could feel it in between the team. I could feel it with the pastors. I could feel it with the leaders that we were meeting with. And I'm Megan, by the way, and this is my husband, TJ. I forget that you guys don't know who we are. We live in Anderson, and Stu was actually our youth pastor when we were in high school. And
that makes me old.
Yep, he's the old man. That's what we call him. I've never actually called him that. And Sean went to... Did you technically go to high school with TJ? I don't know. High school age. Anyways, so we came on this team. We had no idea who the team was with. We had no real meetings with these people. We had like one 30-minute meeting. And we're like, hey, we're going to Guatemala with the team we don't know. And we're not really sure what we're doing. Okay, like, we'll make it work. We had some people from our hometown gather with us the 2 days before we left and just like, can you guys just pray for us? Like, we don't know the team, and I'm sure the team is having support within each other, but we just aren't down there. And so we had our own people like pray over us the night before and just pray into us and what we were worried about and what we were anxious about. And God just answered everything that was prayed over us. And when we got to the team, we got right in. We met new people. We got along. We enjoyed the company. And then we got to Guatemala and we got to Jocotillo. And Jocotillo is the one in the village. So Erwin and Irma is who people have been talking about. And they're the pastors there. And they have this probably 1 to 2 acres worth of land. And on that land, they have done everything God has told them to do. They have heard the cries of their people and they have answered in whatever God has asked them to do. They have pigs that they're raising and they have chickens that they're raising to feed their people, and they have tilapia farm and they have pineapple and they have corn and they have school for their kids and they have church on a weekly basis. And it's those people that actually started the Ecofiltro project. Like, we didn't come up with that idea. What's his name? One of the guys there, he's the one that brought it to us. And I was like, hey, Matilde, he had that idea, brought it to us. And we, the white people, had the money. And it was really cool just to see how much God worked and how God answered prayer and how I went there wanting to do things. But they didn't really need us in the fact that they didn't need me to build something. They didn't need me to put something together. They needed my support, pray and money, and I had that available. I don't know. I am now jumbling for words, so I'm just going to pass on the mic. But he just did good things.
So one of the days when we were in Jocotillo, on the way back, we stopped at the city dump. Now, to get to the city dump, you have to go through the city cemetery, and then you end up on this hill that overlooks the city dump. So you all know what a city dump looks like. There were the garbage trucks dumping garbage in there. There were also thousands of people in there who rummage through the garbage. This is their job. They actually get a permit from the government to rummage through the garbage dump and in hopes to find something that is sellable so that they can feed their family. So we were all just kind of in awe. I mean, nobody was really saying anything. I was just kind of watching this happen, just kind of feeling a lot of different things. I was in awe of what was happening. I felt compassion for these people. I thought, why is it that they have to do that? And I have a really comfortable life, you know. And I had all these thoughts that were, to me, seemed totally fine. But finally, after a bit, I thought, I should ask God what he thinks about it, you know. So I asked God, well, what do you think about this? What do you feel about this? And the Lord said to me very clearly, my people are not trash. My people are treasure. And what was happening was I was seeing their outward condition. I was seeing them with my natural eyes, but like the scripture says in 1 Samuel, the Lord looks on the heart, but we look on the outward appearance. So God was showing me how he sees them spiritually and kind of giving me a different perspective, you know. So I came back from that really just trying to lean into that and wanting to see people and see their situations not with my own eyes, with what I see, but with what God sees in the supernatural.
And I think one of the things that is so poignant for us when we're in Guatemala that we try to bring back and work out in our daily lives is the reality that God's already at work in every situation, in every city, in every scenario. And our role as followers of Jesus is to discern where he's working and what he's up to and then cooperate with him. But like we're Americans, right? So we do our thing when we want to do it. We create it. We, you know, we name it after ourselves. We, you know, whatever it is. And it's just so foreign to the way we're wired to say, okay, God, what are you up to? What are you already doing here that we can join with? And we use the EcoFilter example so many times because it's just such a perfect, we just kept going and going, God, what are you up to? What do you want us to do? And Jason and Sean and I are there and Matilde shows us a water filter and he says, this will save lives every week in my village. If you could just get us these water filters. We go, okay, well, where do we order them from? He's like, oh, they're made here in Guatemala. We're like, what? Yeah, they were invented here. They're made here. You purchased them here. You know, and it was just like God had already set up all the dominoes. And he was like, hey, gringos, you want to knock some dominoes over for the kingdom? And we just looked at each other and went, well, yeah, duh, of course we do. And so, you know, here we are 2 years later, and you, through generosity, have provided clean water to a little over 300 families in Guatemala because you were just the people who said, let's knock over some dominoes for the kingdom. Like, God's already up to it. We didn't have to go in there and, you know, do our own thing. And so it's just trying to bring that home and go, God, what are you up to in my family? What are you up to in that cubicle? What are you doing in that conversation that you want me to cooperate with? I don't have to make anything happen. I'm just going to cooperate with you and be hands and feet. The week is also full of some comedy of errors, right? Some funny moments, some silly stuff. Got a few minutes left. Team, any silly moments throughout the week or, oh my goodness, comedy of errors situations that you'd love to share?
Yeah, so our hotel is in a nice area of downtown Guatemala, and it rains, like, every afternoon during the summer, apparently. And they like on the sidewalks to make them out of, like, marble or tile. And it's tile, not marble. But I don't really wear shoes normally unless I have to. I wear sandals. I think I slipped every single time I went outside. And we were all just, like, sliding. I fell once. It was great. It was a good time.
They sing karaoke in the Chili's restaurants there in Guatemala City, apparently. That's what I'm told.
So my husband came back a completely different man after Guatemala.
He got taller, too.
Yeah, you should tell. He has a tall chair. He's not actually this tall. But he changed in so many ways. We've gone through a lot of struggles this last 6 years, not as a married couple, but just against us as a married couple. It's a whole other thing. But this trip really brought us together. And there's a million things that we've learned and a million things that we're going to change because of this trip. But the funny thing was, to me, is we got home and I was sick getting home. I felt awful. And he thinks it's hilarious. And somebody will probably tell the shaky, shaky, shaky song story here. It's a catchy song that played on the bus that we drove around in. And before this trip, my husband hated Spanish music. He has told me multiple times, I don't know why people listen to it. It doesn't sound good. I don't get it. Like, I don't even understand why it's a genre. It's awful. And we get back, and I'm like holding in all my nausea and my awfulness because we have to drive back into Reading. And he creates a shaky, shaky, shaky station on Pandora.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we listen to Spanish music all the way home. And he's thrilled because now he can listen to his hip-hop rap with the kids. And the kids don't know what it's saying. So it's even better. that was just a little bit of comedy for us.
So the last day that we're there to before we head out to Hokitio, Tita had asked us to stop by so we can take a picture with her. And so we get the address and we plug it into Google Maps. And as Josh said, basically when you plug in an address in Guatemala into Google, it basically just gives you a big middle finger. And we cannot find this place to save our life. And so, you know, through technology and everything else, we finally are able to send our coordinates to Tita. And Tita responds back, "Wow, you are nowhere near our house." But Josh goes over and finds his taxi driver and asks, you know, "Hey, do you know where this is at?" And the taxi driver goes, "Yeah, and hey, just follow us. Just follow me. Just follow me." And he just, without a second thought, without quoting us a price, anything, it just takes us over there. And I think we put together some cash. It's actually more than what he was wanting. And so I'm hoping we gave him all the cash that we had intended to give him. But, like, it was just service and like, "No, well, I'll take you over there. I'll drive out of the way." And it was just kind of the day and kind of getting around. And, I think we missed our turn off for Limonada both days. And it was just kind of, you know, driving around the city. That was kind of how it was, but that was kind of my comedy of the errors idea.
Okay. So I'll tell you the shaky, shaky, shaky story. So we had this driver all week who did not speak a word of English. And in where he was out in the front seat, there was this little TV. And then behind him, so that everybody else could see, there was this giant TV. So one day we're driving. I had my 12-year-old with me for the trip. And he was in the back. And I was close enough to the front that I could see the driver's TV. And he decides he wants to treat us by putting on his music. So he pops in this DVD, and on comes this super catchy, shaky, shaky, shaky song that was super catchy but super inappropriate, like half-naked women. I was like, I don't know if I should cover my eyes. I was very thankful. My 12-year-old could not see the TV. So there's another day. He decides, somebody says, "Put on music." So he puts it in. Well, this time the TV in the back's working. Actually, it didn't matter. Actually, my 12-year-old was in the front sitting with him. That's right. And he's watching this video, and I'm just sitting there mortified, like, should I say something? Should I be the weird one in the group that's like, "This isn't appropriate," you know? So I'm just like, oh, God, he shouldn't be watching this, you know? And finally, thankfully, Stu was in the back, and he's like, "Hey, Cameron, put on the movie Sing." And Cameron's like, "Why?" And I'm like, "Just put the movie on, just put the movie on. Don't watch this."
This is a quick one, but one thing that I'm never going to do again, eat American pineapple. Ever.
And don't eat sketchy Guatemalan food that looks totally undercooked from a sketchy hotel.
So let me explain why Cameron says he's never going to eat pineapple again. So I grew up in Hawaii. They got the Dole plantation there. I love pineapple. Guatemala ruined that. It ruined that. I mean, okay, you go over there, their pineapple is so sweet. It's ridiculous. And then most of the pineapples, you can't eat the core because it's really hard. And no, you can eat. It is tender. And it is, I'm like, how does this even exist? So yes, so I'm not even going to try to, you know, kid myself that pineapple over here is going to be anywhere near that, because I don't think I can take the letdown.
Well, I encourage all of you, as I'm going to kind of wrap us up here, to grab lunch with someone on the team, get their ear, hear more about the ways that God has worked in all of us. And everyone on this team has heard me kind of share my heart that this trip is really more of a kind of a formational pilgrimage for me than it is a missions trip. And while I think that rings true for a lot of us in the way that God and the Spirit worked in our lives, Disciples Church still has a really significant impact in the country of Guatemala. And those of you who have invested in that and have prayed for us need to hear about that. So me, the numbers guy, I'm going to kind of help quantify that for you. And the last two trips, Stu and I went down there with, the last one was Stu, me, and Jeff, or sorry, not Jeff, Beth Biggers. And the trip before that, it was Stu, Jason Blumel, and I. And after the last trip, we looked at each other and tearfully said, I don't know that we can keep bringing three people down here. Disciples needs to catch the vision and the passion that we've had for this country for the last couple of years. And as we prayed over the last year and did some things differently strategically, we brought 16 people down this time. So I'm so grateful for everyone on this team. This was a phenomenal team. I would go anywhere in the world with any of you. So in addition to bringing the 16 people down, we gave another 150 water filters away and provided clean water to 150 families for 2 years. And on top of that, we had some extra financial resources we were able to invest down there. So on our last trip, we purchased a very small plot of land that they have a little schoolhouse on. And Megan didn't mention it, but Megan's a LuLaRoe representative. Those are the leggings that your wives have too many of. Yeah. And just posted something on the message boards, because I guess they have a manufacturing facility in Guatemala, and asked for some money from other LuLaRoe representatives to help out with school supplies for this little schoolhouse that we bought. And in 2 days, they gave over $550 that we were able to buy school supplies for. In addition to that, in Limonada, we gave Tita a sum of money and just told her, hey, we trust whatever you want to do with this. And so the next day she came to us and she said, hey, remember that classroom you were teaching in that was really hot because there's no windows or ventilation? You gave us exactly the amount of money we need to put windows in those classrooms. So we're going to do that next week. And finally, we left some resources in the church in the hill town of El Jocotillo, and I think they're going to buy pigs with it, which is a pretty big deal for them, and they're going to let us know exactly what we do with that. So for those of you who have invested financially in this team and on this trip, those of you who have purchased water filters, Scott Streeter, who's here, who built our water filter display out there, yeah, clap for that. You've all made a really big impact, so I hope that you'll continue to pray for Guatemala and continue to join us, as that is really a kind of our flag in the ground for global missions. So thanks again. Love all of you. Thanks for all your support. And now I have to do the awkward transition to